Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt, and welcome at long last to Empire's Rogue One, a Star Wars Story spoiler special podcast. First things first, apologies for the delay on this one. We know there has been, as one former Empire editor once said, some classic Empire fannying around with this one. We did put the special up on December 19th for a short while. That was a mistake. That was our bad. Sorry about that. Then, as you know, if you've been following the saga on Twitter, we decided to put it up on January 1st. That was to give people time to watch the movie both on both sides of the Atlantic and around the world to see the film, and also as a bit of a New Year's treat. January 1st, you get up and there the podcast is waiting for you. And then, of course, Carrie Fisher passed away just after Christmas. And after we had processed our initial shock and the loss of a legend, we knew that we just couldn't put up the spoiler special as it was. And we couldn't put up a podcast that discusses not only Star Wars, but Princess Leia without acknowledging Carrie Fisher. And so we decided to push it back again until we had time to get back into the office after our Christmas break and record something new. Hope you understand. So here's how the next 90 minutes or so is going to unfold. First of all, you're going to hear the original spoiler special as is. So you'll hear our exclusive interview with Rogue One's director Gareth Edwards, followed by chat about the film from me, James Dyer, Helen O'Hara and Ian Freer. After that, there'll be an additional section where Helen...
Hello.
...and I talk about Carrie Fisher, Princess Leia and her Star Wars legacy. So please stay tuned at the end of the spoiler special for that additional section. Okay, time to settle back, relax, and enjoy the Rogue One, a Star Wars Story spoiler special at long last. And yes, spoilers lurk within from the off, so if you haven't seen Rogue One, go to a cinema, see Rogue One, and then come back. Seems simple enough. With me, I'm one with the force. The force is with me. I'm one with the force. The force is with me. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the latest in our series of spoiler special podcasts. This one is dedicated to the first standalone Star Wars live action movie since Ewok's Battle for Endor. It is, of course, Gareth Edwards' Rogue One, a Star Wars story, which tells the tale of how a group of rebels stole the plans for the first Death Star way back before A New Hope was A New Hope. Over the next 90 minutes or so, I'll be discussing the film in depth with my very own hastily assembled crew of rogues, scoundrels and nerf herders, including, but not limited to, no it is, it's just these guys, James Dyer, author of the four-star review of Rogue One, A Star Wars Story. Hello.
Hello.
How are you?
I am good, thank you very much, Chris.
Excellent. Helen O'Hara, very much the Mon Mothma of this pod.
I will take that. I did meet Mon Mothma the other week.
The real one or the new
friend? Genevieve O'Reilly.
She's great.
Yeah. She's awesome.
Awesome. And last but not least, Ian Freer, a man who thought he'd learned everything there was to learn about Star Wars and so is naturally delighted at all these new planets and character names he has to cram into his noggin. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. I thought you were going to say I'm a reconstructive grandma Grandma Tarkin. You know, I thought the Norman Clincher I was getting.
Yeah, no, I was going to introduce CG Peter Cushing, but he's unavailable. he's off on a remake of Dracula. That's what he's doing. So there we go. Welcome all. And before we get into it, a reminder, we will be discussing spoilers galore on the podcast, third act revelations, big deaths, all that sort of stuff. So if you haven't seen Rogue One, A Star Wars Story, go and see it and then come back here once you have, because then everything we say will make a lot more sense. Well, it'll make sense.
Well,
it'll be words. But first, very first thing you're going to hear, though, is a chat with the director of Rogue One, Gareth Edwards. James,
yes,
where is he, went along to speak to Gareth Edwards earlier this week in a top secret London location. Where was it? Claridge's? Corinthia? Where was
it? Corinthia.
The Corinthia. And talked to him about a great many things. What did you talk about? To give the listeners an idea what they're gonna hear.
Westworld, really, primarily. We chat about that. He's a fan.
Did you stay on target at
we
all?
We stayed on target, yes. We talked about all sorts of thermal exhaust ports above and below the main port. Okay. No, it was good. It was an interesting conversation, as you are about to hear.
Okay. You've sold it to me.
Yeah.
I'm excited about it.
Good.
Let's listen to this. Gareth Edwards talking to James Dyer. Enjoy.
Gareth, welcome to the Empire Podcast. How are you, sir? I am very well. I am good to be back on Earth and no longer in a galaxy far, far away.
It's all calmed down now.
It's a bit boring, to be honest. It gets addictive up there. I kind of want to go back, to be, if I'm honest.
It's like playing with your favourite toy set, I imagine.
It is. No, it's like you're born into a world and there was, like, I was 2 when Star Wars came out, so it was like you grow up with Star Wars figures and AT-ATs and X-Wings and stuff, and that's kind of what you're promised the world is like, and then suddenly you realise actually it's a massive lie. You realise life's actually very boring. And so everyone says, like, wasn't it crazy doing Star Wars? Wasn't it crazy? And you go, no, actually, it was normal. It was what they advertised in the brochure when we were kids. And it was life that was, like, just terribly worse. And so getting to do Star Wars for 2 years was like going back to normal life in a weird way. It's like what you thought it was going to be when you were little.
And you say getting to do Star Wars. This is almost in the purest sense getting to do Star Wars, because it is so... Episode 4, the whole thing, top to bottom, just feels episode 4.
Honestly, if they like laid out, I don't know what they're planning, to be honest, in, you know, for the rest of the films, but if they would, I feel like it, whatever they would lay out and say, would you want to do this, do you want to do that, if you were offered anything else, even the sagas, I would have been like, no, I want to do Rogue One, because that's connected to the film that started me off wanting to do filmmaking, wanting to do everything.
Let's get right into the meat of it. So the film starts, there's no crawl. At what point was that a thing? Was there ever a crawl?
The first screenplay that Gary Whitta wrote had a crawl in it. Mm. I mean, obviously, as a fan, like all of us, he was like, oh, I can't wait to write the crawl in. And you learn doing that a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away has 4 dots in it, not 3.
That's very important.
You get extra marks for that. And then at some point, I can't even remember when it was, probably like 6 months before we were filming, we're in a meeting, they sort of talked about, and we're thinking about not having an opening crawl because, you know, these are standalone films, not part of the sagas. And if I'm honest, there was an initial kind of like, I want the crawl. And then you like it, it's rhythmically, it doesn't really matter what's written on that text, but rhythmically, like letting everyone calm down and stop munching the popcorn and the quiet in the audience, and then it comes, is a really nice thing to have. But our film, basically, they felt like that the opening sequence is kind of the crawl of our movie. It's like the setup. And then our film is also born out of a crawl. Like, the reason we exist is because of a previous crawl. So it feels like this infinite loop that'll never end. And they wanted to differentiate the Star Wars story, like standalone movies, from the sagas. And so it was just something that was decided. And, you know, that's a... small thing to give up to get to do Star Wars, so I was fine with it.
And of course, the opening musical cue is different as well.
Yeah.
And there's a fake out. Giacchino does a fake out. The bit where it starts with the same notes and then goes into a different piece of music slightly further on.
Right.
Which I thought was kind of a nice touch.
Yeah, it's because he just couldn't get the royalties clearance on that.
It's a PRS issue.
I think John Williams owns it.
The things you do also differentiate within this is you have obviously no wipes either.
Yeah.
So more traditional cards and title cards for the planets as well. Was that, again, was it a stylistic differentiation, or did you think, you know, we're doing a lot of planetary movement in this one, we need to kind of keep it out there?
Yeah, these are kind of group decisions because it's stylistically for the stories, you know, the standalones and not the, you know, not being part of the sagas. And so we did have versions of the film where there was wipes and stuff, and then it just felt like we were doing it because we could. And you can't ever... The wipe's the cheesiest thing in the world. The only time you can ever do it and it not be cheesy is in Star Wars.
Yeah.
And so there's something really nice about that efficiency of storytelling where you can just wipe the screen and you're somewhere else. You don't have to do even establishing shots, you know what I mean? The audience gets it. But yeah, I think it was just something that was a gradual process that, you know, incrementally became what it did. And... yeah, I'm, you know, there's part of me that wanted the wipes maybe and things like that. But I think that the film is supposed to be different. We were given a license by the studio to be unique from the others. And we just took that license and ran with it as like this, as an excuse to try and be a bit more out there.
But you do get to use a lot of the old toys. So you use quite a bit of archive footage in this, don't you? I saw red and gold leaders in there. I was like, was that a thing? That was archive footage, right, of those guys?
Yeah, like very early on, you know, we talk about, well, in theory, the X-Wing pilot should be here.
Yeah.
And so we went, you know, on a tour around the archives at Skywalker Ranch, you know, you get to see all the really cool stuff like Darth Vader's helmet, the Millennium Falcon, you know, the Luke Skywalker's lightsaber and jackets and everything, you know, you name it, it's there. And then at the very bottom of the basement, there's all these cans of film. And I just walked past them thinking, I don't know what they could be. There's something else. And I said, what are these? And they said, oh, they're the negatives from Star Wars. And you're like, what? Like, they exist? Have you watched them all? And they went, no. Have you gone through them all? And they're like, not really. We haven't yet. And you're like, oh my God, like, this is like, someone should sit and just digitize all of this stuff. And like, I'd pay for it. I'll sit and watch it. Like, can I do that? And so what we did is we pulled out of the archives all the X-Wing pilot footage and some other bits and bobs. And we just got them rescanned. And they weren't perfect. Obviously, you can imagine they aged quite a bit.
Yeah.
And they need a lot of cleanup from Industrial Light and Magic. But I really wanted to have like Gold Leader and people like that in there. And just as a nod. And it was funny because you do it for yourself as a fan and you think, I wonder how many people will notice. But at the premiere, it got one of the biggest cheers when he showed up. And I was like, I actually punched, you know. Yeah, I love all that stuff. I mean, it's, and you can sort of, in a normal movie, you go, you shouldn't be doing fan service like that because, you know, really you should be thinking of the majority of the world. But with Star Wars, the majority of the world is a fan.
Yeah.
And so I think these things are okay.
I love that you also cast the other pilots with sort of 70s porn stashes as well, so they all look like part of the same squadron.
Yeah, yeah. I used to think some of them were fake, and you go up and you could never guess. The makeup department was really, really good, and you'd have to watch from a distance and have these like sweepstake on who had real sideburns or fake mustache, and you'd never get it right. Everyone that was picked to be background artists, to be honest, you know, a lot of the stipulation was you've got to have like a 70s haircut. And I got a cameo in the film as well. I can maybe talk about it because you've seen the film.
You?
I was at the very end.
Oh, were you? Whereabouts? I totally missed that.
I'm not sure I should say.
See, I'm going to ask you about reference because there's tons of references in there. You've got Blue Milk, Dr. Everzan, obviously, and Ponda Barber turn up, which is a nice touch. So many other things. I heard the sound of the mouse robot, but you don't see. Yeah, exactly that. Yeah. What's the one that you think, A, people won't get, or the one that you're most proud of?
I mean, you've mentioned a few. There are a lot more, obviously.
Yeah.
The Blue Milk was a quick thought. You know, like, I love the whole Blue Milk thing. When I was 30, I went to Tunisia for my birthday and I drank Blue Milk at Luke's house and stuff like that. And we were just on set and there was all these things and it wasn't really, I don't think we planned it. It was just, there was this shot that had to dolly in towards the kitchen and that kitchen was all supposed to look like Luke Skywalker's kitchen. Cause I just think that looks so cool. There was something very, it's like a Nintendo quality to like the console finish to a lot of the tech in Star Wars.
Yeah.
And that sort of 80s kind of Commodore 64 kind of...
Very analog.
Yeah. And so we had a lot of that as reference for all the stuff in the kitchen and things like this. And we're just doing this shot and there was a glass and a thing. It was like, can we get some blue dye? Can we make this Blue Milk? And it wasn't supposed to be front and center. It's just the way it turned out. But there's loads of little Easter eggs in there. I mean, to some extent, it was hard not to turn it into an Easter egg full of Easter eggs. Like, I feel, you know, there was 1,000 things we could have done and we probably did like 50, you know.
But you get some pretty awesome front and center callbacks, not least of all the Dark Lord of the Sith himself, which is kind of pretty exciting. It was also very interesting to see him when we come across him first, sort of floating in the Bacta tank. Was that an idea that you wanted to do something with Vader that we've never really fully seen before?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm jealous of moments like in Empire Strikes Back where you see the back of his head.
Yeah.
And you just go, oh my God, that is so cool. And wanted to try and find something like that in our film. And just looking back at images and things for like fun when we started this process, like I'm a big fan of, it was like Chris Cunningham inspired thing of like the idea of being in milk and like with all is full of love. And he did some other videos where people floating in water and stuff. And it was just like, I'd love to do something with Vader where he's just like, because he's really a burns victim, you know what I mean? And it's not going to be fun for him when he's not in the suit and he's going to be uncomfortable. So, and I love the idea of showing that he's vulnerable as well. Like, everyone in this movie wanted to set them up to have like contradictory character traits, you know, like no one's just clean, like no one gets out of this movie just either being bad or good. Vader's very, very bad. And so you try and just glimpse something of him that gives him some humanity or makes you empathize with him.
Yeah.
And I think just seeing those scars and realizing that he's kind of, you know, an amputee, and just reminding you of that before he does all his stuff.
Yeah.
It makes you torn, I think. It just helps. He's just such a rich character, like, in so many ways.
Until you show he's a massive badass near the end.
Yeah, then you sort of don't feel sorry for him anymore.
And that's something we've never really seen him kind of let rip in quite that way before. So that's kind of, it's quite a special moment, I think, for Vader fans.
There was, we were at Pinewood and Peter Jackson was in town, and Jabez, who was one of the editors on the film, worked on Lord of the Rings and King Kong and everything. And we were like, we should get Peter along. We should try and get him to come. And it was, you know, very busy, and you can't really get hold of him, and has, you know, he's got loads of things on his schedule, and then I was just there, we were about to shoot that scene, and I thought, oh, you know what, screw it. And I just, like, wrote an email saying, Pete, we're about to film Darth Vader, if you want to come, it's happening now. And he's like, I'll be there in half an hour, like this. And then he perfectly timed it. He walked in, literally, for that shot where it goes from darkness to the lightsaber. Beautiful. Turning on. Yeah. And he kind of walked in just before we did the take, and he's like, what are you filming? And I said, oh, you're about to see. And we went, action. And it did that whole take that's in the movie where it went down past those people, and then he turns it on, and it felt really cool. It felt like, I don't know, there's a, you know, whatever I do in my career, whatever happens next, it's going to be hard to top the honor of getting to direct that scene.
Yeah. I mean, it's an incredible sort of sequence visually, but I think the ballsiest thing about this whole film feels like the fact that as you get towards the end, you realise this is a suicide mission. Do you know what I mean? That this is, it's actually an incredibly bold thing to do with a Star Wars movie. Was that always the case, or was it something that you kind of decided would work best after the fact?
I mean, it's a great Disney tradition, isn't it, for every single character to die in all their movies. I mean,
certainly their parents.
Yeah. I think there was an early version, the very first version, they didn't. In the screenplay. Mm. And it was just assumed by us that we couldn't do that. They're not going to let us do that. So let's try and figure out how this ends, where that doesn't happen. And then everyone read that, and there was just this feeling of like, they've got to die, right? And everyone was like, yeah, can we? And we thought we weren't going to be allowed to, but Kathy and everyone at Disney were like, yeah, it makes sense. Mm. I guess they have to, because they're not in A New Hope. And so from that point on, like, we had the license, and I kept waiting for someone to go, you know what, could we just film an extra scene where we see Jin and Cassian, they're okay and they're on another planet and la la la, and never ever came. No one ever gave us that note, and so we got to do it.
Because I was waiting for, I thought she might get rescued, because there's a shot in the trailer of the TIE fighter coming up right in front of that sort of promontory bear. Mm. Was that not a rescue so much as an attack when in the uncut footage?
That came about. There's a fair bit of footage, obviously. I think waiting for the websites to begin that analyze what was in the marketing and what was in the film and things like that. Yeah, there was a bit of a process to refining the third act in terms of the specific shots and moments, and so certain things just fell away. But then what happens is marketing love those shots and go, oh, we've got to use that, you know. And you say, well, it's not in the movie, and it's like, it's okay. It's what marketing does, you know. We just use the best of whatever you've done, but towards the end you go, I know that's not in the film, but the spirit of it's in the film, you know, and things like that, and so that it would happen. And yeah,
well, the last thing I want to ask you about before I run out of time is Peter Cushing.
Right
now, George did that in episode 3, but nowhere near as well. At what point did you realise we can actually do this, and we can actually, because it looks like, I mean, you use him tons. I mean, it's an incredible achievement, and the voice actor is amazing. Where did you find him?
It's Guy Henry, his name, and it was sort of tricky to convince Guy. He was brilliant, but you're basically going up to an actor and saying, now you're going to be in a film, it's a big film, it's called Star Wars, but we're not going to see your face. You actually look totally like someone else, and you're not allowed to tell anyone. And it's like there's nothing in it for them, you know what I mean? And so it's quite an ask of an actor to say, could you do this? And Gina Jay, who was our casting director, she was looking everywhere. We were looking at every possible person. And suddenly she just sent me this clip one day. I remember I was with one of the producers, and we just played it, and it was Guy Henry. And he was like, he inhabited, like, his whole way about him was like Peter Cushing. And as soon as that clip ended, we just looked at each other and went, we found him. And then I had to go and convince him in a restaurant, like, to do this. And he was kind of flattered. And he said, you know what was really interesting about it is that Guy Henry started his TV career in the UK playing young Sherlock Holmes. And he said to me that what he used to do to get into the role was he'd watch all the old Peter Cushing Sherlock Holmes films. And because he would try and not impersonate Peter Cushing, but because he tried to absorb that in his character, and then he became famous for that, he sort of kept Peter Cushing in him throughout the years. And he said, you know what, if you'd told me anyone else in the world that you wanted me to mimic, I would have been like, no, I can't. No, that's wrong. I don't know why you're asking me. And he says, but the fact it's Peter Cushing, I'm like, yeah, I know what you mean. And so he came on set and he had to wear all this crazy stuff, this headpiece. And it was really like distracting for not him mainly, but everybody else as well. It's hard to sort of just talk to someone. They got this,
yeah,
they look like Doc Brown from Back to the Future when Marty turns up that time. But it's incredible. And Industrial Light and Magic, and John Knoll needs a lot of credit for this, because everyone was kind of like, can we do this? Are you sure we can do this, John? Should we just kind of limit it to one shot? Should we hide them? And John was like, no, we can do this. We can do this. And so it was just treat him like any other actor and put him in the film as much as he needs to be, and then cross your fingers and hope that ILM can do their magic.
And they did.
Yeah, it was pretty good.
The last word of the film is from another CG character. Is that taken from the speech in A New Hope? Just the dialogue, is it lifted?
The dialogue is taken, yes.
Just that word is taken out from
it. But not the image. No. It's a 3D.
Yeah, it's a 3D composite, but yeah. Nice. Well, Gareth, thank you very much indeed.
No, thank you. Thanks a lot. Cheers, thanks.
Okay, so that's Gareth Edwards out of the way. He's done. He's dusted.
Did you notice the part in this where I brought up the score fake out? There's a bit where the opening note, which I believe, I want to say, is it C-flat major? Yeah, C-flat major. The
Nerd.
First note, yeah, thank you, of the main title for Star Wars plays at one point during the film, and then it goes off into something else. Uh-huh. And it was a big fake out. And as I was saying this to Gareth, he looked at me absolutely blankly as if I was speaking botchy. And clearly has no idea
which
what I'm talking about.
Which you can do.
Which I can do. So either I'm going insane or he is. It's one of the two.
At which point?
I think I have a preference.
Really?
And a guess.
Yeah.
At which point does it take place?
It's entirely possible that I am making this up. It's not the very beginning. It's about, I want to say, about 20, 30 minutes in. There's a bit where you hear C-flat major, or maybe I just wanted to hear it. And you hear it go out, and then it goes off in a kind of...
Okay.
Or something similar.
All right.
And it wasn't what I thought it would be.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. But okay, before we get into it, so what we've done is we have canvassed a load of questions from Twitter, from email, all sorts of stuff. People asking us about the film in great detail. But before we get into that, let's just get a quick sort of overview of where we are with the movie. I really, really like this. I thought this was the movie. This is the movie I wanted The Force Awakens to be. It's drenched in nostalgia. It's got a lot of fan service moments in there, but it goes into new territory, dark territory, does surprising things in a way that I thought The Force Awakens didn't. Helen?
It was very much on a level with Force Awakens for me in terms of how much I liked it immediately. I think with Force Awakens, I probably fell more for the characters, and with this one, I maybe fell more slightly for the plot or certainly the action scenes. And the second half of this film, I think, is at least as good as anything we've seen this year. I thought it was phenomenal.
Interesting.
I'm going to say it's the best blockbuster of 2016.
Wow.
I know I prefer Stormtroopers to Iron Man in terms of people who wear helmets.
I'm pretty sure Iron Man's in this movie. At least.
But I just figured that, obviously all the Star Wars stuff is great, but it's a blockbuster that has a really solid premise. It's just a great idea for a film. And so many modern blockbusters today seem so confusing to me. And I can't really get my head around them. And this is a very simple idea. How do they steal the Death Star plans? And I think it worked.
Yeah.
It's great.
To put in context, Ian, you've probably forgotten more about Star Wars than any of us in this room know, including James Dyer.
Ooh. Our challenge is set.
Well, I'll say James knows more about the fictional world and I know more about the making
of. I think that's fair.
Expanded universe, which is no longer canon.
Because we wrote...
All that time was spent...
Ian and I wrote the ultimate Star Wars quiz together, didn't we?
Yes,
do you remember we did for Celebration Europe? God, when was that, 10 years ago? Something like that.
Yeah. So it's kind of like Darth Vader and Luke Skywalker ruling the galaxy together.
Exactly, like father and son. And Ian did all of the production questions and I did all the really nerdy planet and stuff questions.
Mm.
So, yeah.
And Jimbo, what did you think of the movie? Four stars, Empire Magazine?
I did indeed give it four stars. Yes, I enjoyed it very much. Mm-hmm. If I'm honest, I didn't enjoy it as much as...
You didn't enjoy it?
I didn't enjoy
it.
I did not enjoy it as much as The Force Awakens.
Okay.
And the reasons are, I think, as Kellen's... as Kellen?
Yeah, sure. That's my Star Wars
so
name.
Well with the language. As Helen said, the characters, I think, were the down point on this for me, that they were a little bit bland and they didn't stand out and they're not classic Star Wars characters. I like Krennic a lot, but apart from him, I found the others quite forgettable. I like Chirrut Imwe, I think. Mm. But for me, I think the problem is that while it was at once the most Star Wars film in that it threw back to the 70s and it threw back to A New Hope so much, but also the least Star Wars film because it ejected many of the trappings of Star Wars. So no wipes, no crawl, no fanfare. The music, as I'm sure we're going to talk later, was a big issue for me. The thing with Star Wars, it gives me a feeling, a little feeling in the pit of my stomach, like I'm 5 years old again, this is the greatest moment of my life. And this film, while I loved it, didn't give me that feeling. And I think it's because it's missing so many of those trappings. And weirdly, I also reviewed the Clone Wars movie. And that had the same issue for me. Obviously, it's an animation, it's a very different thing. But my biggest problem with that is it didn't feel like a Star Wars film. Again, no fanfare, no Williams. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, the music and the trappings and the wipes and all that, that's all part of the Star Wars experience. And I get that they've tried to thematically and stylistically separate this from the episodes and make it its own thing, but I would rather they hadn't.
I want to defend it a little bit on that score, and actually on the characters as well.
On that score?
I actually liked the characters. I just didn't fall in love with anybody as much as I fell in love with BB-8, Kylo Ren and Poe Dameron in extremely different ways. I would agree about Chimrit. It was a standout. He and Baze's relationship was great. Mm. But I think actually they did a lot with very little time. I really liked K2SO as well. I thought he was great.
As did I.
But on the score, because you'd come back from a screening earlier than me and endlessly bitched about it, I was trying to pay half a mind to it. And I think it wasn't bad. I think Giacchino, who had very little time to do this, after it being brought in what, September, after Alexandre Desplat had to depart the project for scheduling reasons, he used a lot of Williams' smaller cues, didn't he? And he used a lot of the same instruments and the same sounds and the same tones. So I didn't miss the big fanfares as much because it still felt Star Wars-y to me. I don't know.
Because I don't think you can have the Star Wars theme in this film. The Star Wars film theme is Luke's theme. That's what it is.
Yeah.
So you can't have that in this film.
You could have the main, title. You could have a bit more Imperial marching. You could have some more. I wanted more familiar cues.
He would have got hit over the head if he'd have done wall-to-wall Imperial march.
Yeah, I think
so
you're right.
I
should qualify this by saying I think Michael Giacchino is a really great composer. He's done great work at Up and Star Trek and so many great things, but in this one, I really felt it was a very vanilla score. Sorry, Michael, I really, really like your work, but I did not like it.
I'm sure he's listening.
I'm sure he is. And I take your time thing, and he did have to turn it around very, very quickly, but in the nicest way, James Horner did the Alien score in like his lunch hour. So yeah, that's not an excuse.
Yeah, it was very easy for him. He went, ooh, which other composers do I like? Including myself.
I don't know what you're saying.
I'll take my Star Trek 2 score.
Have you ever looked up, there's a supercut online called James Horner Danger.
Really?
Just look that one up, okay?
Interesting.
Well, I would rather that Giacchino had cribbed loads more Williams and just made it feel that way. And one of the things that stands out for me is maybe people do realise, but I didn't realise to the extent that Williams score breathes so much dynamism into the action of Star Wars. It's almost inseparable from it. And you look at the Battle of Endor, you look at the Battle of Yavin, and those dogfights are very well shot, but it's the music that brings them to life. Like in the scene where the Millennium Falcon is escaping from the Death Star and they have the gun turret battles with the TIE fighters. It's so energetic, and it's all Williams that does that. And yet then you look at the dogfight at the end of this, and it's a really, really great dogfight, some incredibly inventive moments, colliding Star Destroyers, but I found the kind of humdrum score kind of leached excitement from it.
I think, in fairness, we've all seen this film just once.
Yep.
And that's very unusual for a spoiler special. I like to see a film at least twice, but just couldn't. And I think we've seen Star Wars hundreds of times.
If not thousands.
We've heard the soundtrack thousands of times.
Yeah.
And we know that off by heart.
Yeah.
We know those cues off by heart. And there are humdrum moments in a Williams score as well. And I think in time, we will learn to love the soundtrack as well. I have no problem with the soundtrack. One of my Twitter followers had a real problem with the soundtrack as well. I don't think he's a Giacchino fan anyway. Hello, Dave, if you're listening. But I didn't mind it. I downloaded it this morning. This is being recorded on Friday. It was available on iTunes this morning. I downloaded it, listened to it. It's fine. It's okay. It's perhaps not his best score of the year.
Does it have pun titles?
It doesn't, and that's very interesting. It doesn't have pun titles, and I wonder if he wasn't allowed to do pun titles.
Or is he doing a James Patterson? Is this like the new Alex Cross novel, where it's Michael Giacchino in association with Johnny Work Experience?
No. The biggest Star Wars fan. He's just being reverent.
Yeah, he's huge.
It sounds a lot like John Williams to me. But the
journey to Edo music, that is John Williams. That's fantastic.
And there's a really great... I'm not sure which track it is because I was listening to it without looking at the tracks, but I'm pretty sure it's the track that plays as the giant shockwave cloud destroys Jedha City. And there's a lovely, long, discordant note that ends that. That's fantastic. But anyway, we're not here to delve into the soundtrack because we don't have that much time. But your point, before we get on to the readers' questions, listeners' questions, sorry, magazine habits, is about, does this feel like a Star Wars movie? And I feel that there's an interesting conflict at the heart of this movie in that it begins with the words, a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. I did not expect that. And so that almost then primes you for the crawl. And when it didn't come, I was okay with it. And I think one of the reasons why there's no crawl is that the crawl sets in place the story. And this movie takes place... This movie, stylistically, is very, very different. Structurally, it's very, very different. Correct me if I'm wrong again, guys, but I think this is the first Star Wars live-action movie in which there's a time leap. Am I right in that? Like a proper time leap, like a proper... it jumps 15, 20 years ahead, and therefore a crawl wouldn't work. What would the crawl say? Yeah. Galen Erso is, you know, that's all going to be filled in dialogue.
The crawl is essentially a book called Catalyst, the James Erso book, which kind of tells you the backstory of Krennic and Galen Erso. So it's kind of all in that kind of different kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Different
so you
format.
Said just get that book. Type it into your computer, convert it into a crawl, and then before the movie, just
watch it.
That.
Like bring your iPad to the cinema.
All 300 pages.
I'll tell you what felt least Star Wars to me. It wasn't so much that, and we did then cut to a planet and a spaceship, as is traditional. Mm-hmm. What felt least Star Wars to me, and the moment which really kind of took me aback...
Was it the clowns?
No. It was Forrest Whitaker, Saul Guerrero, not fighting to stay alive. That was the biggest moment for me, realizing, oh, this is not a Star Wars film like the others. That made no sense to me in a sort of a Star Wars context.
Or indeed any context.
Well, I mean, in fairness, he was limping quite slowly. He was Limpy McLimperson, and he decided not to limp away and possibly, you know, slow down other people so they didn't survive either.
Because I thought it was going to be a big last stand at that point, but his last stand is looking out of a window.
There's and nothing even to stand you, against. Oh, I think that's the point.
McLimpface, you know, you can still get onto the ship.
But I think, I would actually agree with part of that quibble, but I do think there's a point about the Death Star not being something that someone like him can fight against, you know.
Yeah.
There is a limit to guerrilla warfare and it is a nuclear bomb, for example. It's that kind of a feel. But that was the moment where I was like, oh, this is not Star Wars. This is someone throwing his life away. This is not what happens. And similarly then at the end, which we're obviously going to talk quite a bit about, this is a spoiler podcast, everybody. On the beach, they're just on the beach, and they're there, and they're not they're not frantically looking around for a ship. I think they've already realized there isn't a ship handy enough to save them. They're just going to die. That's not Star Wars.
No, and everybody dies.
And everybody dies.
It's a bloodbath.
Yeah.
I died.
Yes.
Had to be revived.
I love that last shot on the beach. And you could have to look away from the fact that the Death Star gunner misses the target by a good 50 miles, just clips the top of the... But that's drama.
It's an experimental space station.
Yeah. And I love that the Death Star also apparently now has a low power setting.
That's that was cool.
Single ball destruction.
Yeah, of course. I mean, why you just destroying planets, if that's the only thing you can do, then that's a bit pointless.
It's a bit of a blunt instrument, isn't it, really?
Indeed.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
You've destroyed all the planets, what's left.
Yeah.
Very bold. That just kill everyone. And it makes sense because they don't turn up elsewhere in the mythology, but I think you could have got around that. I'm impressed he was allowed to. I mean, as Gareth said in the interview, you know, it's like they kind of... He wasn't sure he'd be allowed to and was kind of, I think, surprised that he was allowed to kill everyone.
Yeah, you know, we're obviously answering a lot of questions that people have sent in already about the characters and about the deaths in the movie because, as you say, everybody dies in a way that completely surprised me. And that's one of the things I loved about it. A lot of people have written in asking, at what point do we know? Do we know beforehand that everyone was going to die? Personally, I thought this was going to be a sort of Disney-fied version, for want of a better verb, of Star Wars, that you would have a suicide mission where they all get away.
or at least most.
Or at least most.
Yeah.
We knew, can we say that we knew that Donnie Yen was going to die?
Because only
Chang
Wen
said it.
Chang Wen at Star Wars Celebration in Europe accidentally let slip that Donnie Yen's character dies, and that was amazing. I knew that, but I was genuinely surprised.
Yeah.
By a lot of the other deaths, and the final moment, whether in the original ending, Cassian Andor was still alive for that moment on the beach. It feels slightly to me that he had died in a previous
version.
The
deep impact moment.
Yeah, the deep impact
moment. Yeah, that's what I was thinking of as well. Mm-hmm. Hi, Tia Leone, you know?
Absolutely. I thought it was a lovely, lovely moment, and a really, really bold decision from a storytelling point of view to do that.
Because I think even up until they got to the beach, you thought they would live. You thought, okay, we've killed everybody else because it's high stakes, but somehow they're going to survive, right? I mean, there's going to be like an X-wing with a cable that they can climb up onto or something.
Admiral Akbar is going to appear out of nowhere and just go, get onto my ship.
No, it was what was it? Radish.
Radish.
Yes. Radish.
Radis. Radis.
Pilot of the Radisson.
Right.
it's a bold move, and it's in keeping with what the movie is.
Yeah.
It's a war movie. It's a movie about guerrilla warfare. It's a movie that's very, very about now, I would say. It's very much about where we are at the moment, and it fascinated me. It's a movie that reminded me a lot of great, World War II movies, guys on a mission movies. Yeah. And
one thing
it
didn't do from that genre that I thought it was going to do was have a rat in the house.
I thought that as well. Bodhi
Frank
Brook
O'Neill
was going to
in Force 10 from Navarone or something.
Telly Savalas in Dirty Dozen. You know, someone who turns on his own team. I thought it was going to be the Riz Ahmed character. I thought he was being set up as the snake in the grass, so to speak. But it didn't turn out that way. Everyone was very much straight and narrow, and this is what.
But they weren't though. I mean, Cassian Andor really wasn't. Is something we haven't seen.
Shoots a guy in the back.
A guy in the back. An ally as at that, in the back.
And I don't think of Diego Luna as a steely actor. I don't think of him like that. I think he was great.
Yeah, very, very good indeed.
Although it did make it a little bit ridiculous when then Chimrit asked, does he have the eyes of a killer? When you're kind of thinking, well, logically he should, right?
Yeah, but he doesn't. He has the eyes of a lovely puppy dog.
He does.
Yeah.
I agree.
Yeah.
But
it's a lot of those movies, the Dirty Dozen, one of the actual Dirty Dozen makes it out. There's a lot of these World War II movies where nobody makes it out alive. I thought that was really, really great.
Yeah, and there was a nice fan theory that Jyn Erso was the TIE fighter pilot that clips into Vader in the Death Star trench. And that was that, so she finally does the job. So I thought, that'd be great if that happened, but no, they all went.
No. Yeah. Although, in time-honored tradition, we don't see the bodies. So they're still... they might still be around. You never know. An air pocket. You never know. But I thought everyone had a really lovely moment, a lovely death moment as well, and props to them for pushing on with that. So what we're going to do now, we're going to take we got lots of questions sent in via Twitter and via email. So here, a couple from Lucian Waugh Daily. I'm just going to take them in the order in which I received them. Mm-hmm. Do you think the Rogue One characters will be referenced in future episodes? Capital E.
It wouldn't make a lot of sense given that they weren't in the first three.
Yeah.
Beyond after a battle, Princess Leia has the plans kind of thing.
I think no. I think that's...
Another question. Who is Bail Organa talking about when he references the female Jedi he would trust
with his Jedi.
Life?
He doesn't say Jedi.
I know.
I'm just correcting the question as you're saying
it. He's referring to Leia.
He's referring to Leia. He would trust Leia with his life.
He also has a throwaway reference to Captain Antilles, doesn't he?
He does, yes. Yeah. You can just about hear. Yes, he's talking about Leia there, as we saw at the end of the movie. We'll talk about that in a second, because... Here's a question. Could the Peter Cushing resurrection software, which I believe is what it's called, you can buy it off the shelf, be used to immortalize / de-age Harrison Ford forever?
Well, this is, I mean, okay. So
many questions about this, by the way.
This is the holy grail of VFX, is creating an entirely convincing CG human, whether a recreation of an existing person or an entirely, new human creation. And I think this shows that they've come a long way. I think it also shows they're not there yet.
No.
So it was really interesting. It shows a huge degree of confidence for the filmmakers to put Peter Cushing in as many scenes as they did and to finish with Princess Leia in the way that they did. I think they were both, from an art point of view, exceptionally well done. But I think from a technology point of view, we're still really good at spotting fake humans, like as a species.
Mm.
And that's why the edge of the uncanny valley is a vast desert, basically, even though they keep inching closer to the edge.
Yeah. You can tell. I mean, there's a moment in Doctor Strange where Mads Mikkelsen goes from being Mads Mikkelsen to CG Mads Mikkelsen for just a second.
Yeah.
But you can tell. It's about weight and about texture and about, you know, just having a sense of mass.
And this is why they have as many physicists on VFX teams as they do artists, you know.
But don't they introduce Tarkin as a reflection in a kind of a window?
Yes, and that worked
that's
great.
That's gorgeous. That's how you do that. So I wondered if they were going to be a bit more
circumspect.
Yeah.
Look at this and then look at Tarkin at the end of episode 3 and it's just worlds apart.
Yeah.
I mean, he looked incredible. His lips didn't move
fast enough.
That's
a block of makeup, isn't it?
CG stuff there.
There's
as well,
CG
though,
on top.
Is it CG makeup?
Yes, CG makeup.
No, because
it's a combination of the two. Yeah. They had a guy there, and then it's digitally enhanced.
It seems to me that both Tarkin and Leia are further on from Jeff Bridges.
It is getting there, but it was for me the mouth movements. Like, it didn't seem to match the words quite right. Like, his lips didn't move quite quick enough.
No, his eyes weren't quite there. There was no life in the eyes.
But what about that thing that, you know, Carrie Fisher's here to say, yes, you can do this?
Yeah.
Peter Cushing isn't.
Well, actually, there was a thanks to the estate of Peter Cushing in the credits. So presumably, at least his nearest and dearest signed off on it.
Mm. Yeah.
Presumably.
We can't speak for Peter Cushing, who was an amazing, lovely, lovely guy. But I'm not so sure he would have signed off this personally. I mean,
I can recommend watching The Congress for anyone who's interested in questions about signing off on use of your image, because that's kind of the theme of that entire film. He was not a guy to turn his nose up at effects or makeup and things like that, so maybe he would have been cool with it.
I think also there were some of the best scenes, like him sparring with Krennic. I loved it. I love that he's not just a super villain; he's a massive workplace twat as well, stealing credit for other people's work. I mean, he's evil in every possible way.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
It is interesting. I mean, I was so taken out of the movie when I realized he was actually in it as a character that I didn't really concentrate on the dialogue between him and Krennic for about the first 2 minutes of that scene.
Mm-hmm.
So they could have been saying anything, and I honestly would have missed me.
I don't think it's the eyes. Surprise. I think it's the skin still.
It's everything.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
It's just not a good enough effect. It's not the Scorpion King in The Mummy Returns.
Oh, good God, no.
It's not that.
It's a quantum leap from
it's
there.
An incredible effect. It's just not 100% convincing.
Yeah. It's just not there. And the Leia one at the end is even more off-putting. And it's a bit of a shame because I really, really like this movie. I think it's a fantastic Star Wars film in many ways. And that just to end on obviously fake Leia.
I was happy with it, actually. Mm. I was happy with her.
Yeah.
I liked Cushing as well. I thought they were fantastic. Weirdly, I had more issues with Vader than I did with either Tarkin or Leia being in there, because Vader in it, there were a few things that really bugged me, like the chain that holds his cloak on was tucked up right underneath his visor, and that really irritated
me. Absolutely ruined the film for me.
No, but there was something about his
Don't you mock me.
I genuinely noticed something weird about his cloak as well, and I couldn't figure out what it was.
It wasn't quite right, and also the way he moved wasn't quite right either. Vader has a certain sort of like deliberate aspect to his movie, and he has a certain stillness to him, and I thought it was lacking. Not that I'm saying Dave Prowse should have got the job, but he didn't move quite like Vader, and especially when he turns around to force choke Krennic, that felt caricatured, and that didn't feel like Vader moving to me.
It was great for them to try a joke after that, I thought. Kind of a Roger Moore-esque kind of or Empire Strikes Back kind of line.
What, careful you don't choke on your ambition, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Something like that. Yeah. Tell me this, was he built his Tower of Sauron in Mustafar? Is that Mustafar?
Yes, Mustafar, yes.
So that's where he was crippled, where he lost everything.
Pablo Hidalgo, who's the part of the story group at Lucasfilm, confirmed yesterday on Twitter that it was Mustafar.
It was Mustafar.
Why would he make that his base?
Because that's where he lost everything.
It's where he was born.
And because they have very attractive love.
He was born on Mustafar?
Also, as a behind-the-scenes...
As Darth Vader.
As a behind-the-scenes nerd, that's concept art from Ralph McQuarrie that was rejected for Empire Strikes Back. So that lifted my heart. That was so exciting.
I recognise that. I've got my art book.
It's great. I'm glad, because Star Wars has this habit of, you know, duplicating planets. There's a couple of desert planets. And I'm glad that there's just one volcanic lava planet. And why wouldn't you build your big citadel of evil there? I liked Vader in his film.
The estate agent was great on that.
Yeah. Very, very good indeed. I mean, we have someone actually wrote in, Jan Harald Fredheim. He's Norwegian. He says the actor who plays Princess Leia is Norwegian, Ingvild Dala. She was last seen as World Hub Tech in Avengers Age of Ultron. Obviously, then they did face replacement on
That's
her as well.
Good knowledge.
Well done.
Thank you, Jan Harald, for that. Personally, I think this is a step too far. I think this is something that is just fundamentally wrong to do, to take an actor who is dead and put them in a movie without their consent is just wrong.
I have no
problem with it. The role.
I think if the estate has signed off on it, it isn't.
I think that's wrong. I think the estate cannot speak for Peter Cushing. They cannot speak for Audrey Hepburn advertising bloody chocolate.
Well,
they
cannot do that. I think what actors are going to have to do nowadays, and maybe all of us, I don't know, is put something in our will saying, no, you don't get to use my image.
Yeah, don't use my image.
Because people have done that.
Yeah.
And like Beastie Boys music can't be used in adverts, for example, because of Adam Yauch's will.
Okay.
Adam Yauch.
Let's have another question, Chris.
Adam Yauch. Let's have another question. Yep. Here's a question from Martin Ngwong, who says, why did the 10 men need to make the noise of 100 men? Why make no noise, sneak in as they did, get the plans, waltz out, and act like nothing's wrong?
I think they figured they wouldn't be able to, didn't they? I mean, judging by that setup.
The whole principle of this is it's a diversionary tactic, isn't it? They're out there creating a diversion to draw forces away from the archive where the two of them, or three if you count K2, are getting the plans.
Yeah. So I mean, and actually they don't go into action until K2 analyses the situation and says there's 89 stormtroopers between us and the vault. Mm. That's when they
Favourite things of that sequence was Riz Ahmed shouting the instructions to bring down the shield.
Plug it into this and then you've got to find a switch. We don't need to know, Riz.
Is there a Maplins? Can you find a Maplins?
You need an HDMI cable.
I'll tell you what as well, another thing that I thought was interesting and different from Star Wars is instead of R2-D2 trundling over to a wall socket and plugging into it, you have K2SO sticking a knife in another droid's head.
Yeah.
Now that is, again, a little bit harder edge.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, he was.
Yeah.
He was hardcore.
I liked him.
Also, I like how modern it is in that you have to get up high to get a signal. That's the thing, isn't it? You have to go as high as you can to communicate with people these days. And even in Star Wars, that's the case.
Yeah.
Here's a question from Jacob Gustafson. Jacob Gustafson. Loved the film, but it asked so many new questions. Why did so many people follow Saul Guerrero when he just seemed like a weird guy? Did the octopus find out that Bodhi wasn't lying and they still put him in a cell? How did Chirrut and Baze become best friends? Why do we need to know that? Chewie, we just assume that they're best friends. And they
work together. It's a workplace friendship. They were guardians of the temple.
They were guardians of the wills.
Indeed.
Which is a riff back to obviously the first draft of the Star Wars. Screenplay. And yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And they mention, what was the other reference to that I've completely forgotten?
There's one where before you see Chirrut Imwe, he's talking about the
force of others.
Others.
Yes, that's others, right.
Which is what Lucas called the force of others in the force in the first draft.
So what were the other bits of the question?
Why did so many people follow Saul when he seemed like a weird guy?
Well, he's Forrest Whitaker. And B, he'd literally given up quite a lot of parts of his body to defeat the Empire, which gives you a certain amount of moral cachet.
He was like Dennis Hopper in Blue Velvet.
What was the second question about the squid?
He's an extremist. People follow him. Why do people follow extremists? Did the octopus find out Bodhi wasn't lying?
I think so.
Yeah.
But then Paul the psychic octopus. He was predicting the World Cup results.
He was predicting Brexit. And now he's predicting what the pilot was going to say.
Yeah.
What else would they do with him? He'd gone a bit doolally after having been, you know, mind sucked. So
yeah, it was like the earworms in Wrath of Khan.
Yeah.
The truth octopus.
The truth octopus. Do we know what that creature's called?
I'm sure it has a name. Os Pablo.
Yep.
We'll just call him Pablo for the time being. Pablo the Psychic Octopus. Simon from Twickenham asks, do you feel that films that fill in the blank between other films lose something? I felt an issue with this film is I knew what happened, or I know what happens next, so there wasn't as much tension for me.
Mm. It's not really about what happened next, is it? It's about the how and the why of it.
Yeah.
How did they get the Death Star plans? Mm. What was the reasoning behind it and all that kind of thing? So I don't think you needed to know. It didn't spoil my enjoyment that we knew they got plans.
Yeah, the fact that these are new characters and we know that they don't exist in the current Star Wars universe, that brought with it an inbuilt tension for me, because anything could happen to them, and did, yeah. Mm-hmm. At any time. And I think that just automatically generates,
yeah,
suspense, doesn't
it? It was a lovely idea at the heart of it, that Galen had inserted this flaw.
Yeah.
Yes.
And it answers a big logical hole in Star Wars, which is why do you build something that has this gigantic flaw in it?
It was a really smart idea.
Very smart. I do think one of the things I really like about this film is it does give us a new angle to go into A New Hope with. Like, you go in and you see the Tantive IV, and you get that why these guys are terrified when they're surrounding the door, because they've just seen all of their colleagues get killed by this dude. They're really scared.
Except none of that now makes any sense.
Because why?
The whole Tantive IV thing bugged me, because, like, obviously he meets Leia and he said several transmissions have been intercepted that have come to this ship, and it's just like, no, you literally watched them steal it and run away. You were standing there watching the ship run away, and Leia's going, oh, we're on a diplomatic mission. He's like, I watched you steal the plans.
No, diplomatic mission, honest, Gov, honest.
He's like, liar, pants on fire. I was right there. I was on the ship.
Well, he doesn't know it's the same ship. We saw another 11 nacelled ship, you know, flying away.
Yeah, huh.
We did.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
I counted.
Yes, Your Honour.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. No, I feel that's really interesting. Well, why would she be on the ship in the first place in the middle of battle?
Also, maybe it's gone. Maybe there's a little bit of time in between the two.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, we may not track it down automatically. Yeah. It may just be flying somewhere else. But yeah, I didn't mind that. Adam Shortland has a number of questions that we've kind of covered. We talked about the score a little bit. We talked about the fact that it doesn't necessarily feel like Star Wars, which is something I really enjoyed. The Vader final scene was great from a fanboy point of view. It's kind of what Helen just said. You know, he just kills a bunch of dudes. That's clearly a fan service moment. Mm. I wonder if that was in there before the reshoots and the rewrites and whatnot. But it's an interesting moment. But does it match up with the Vader we meet at the beginning of New Hope?
He's more dynamic, though, isn't it? You don't. That's the thing that Vader does a lot in the fan fiction and in the games and stuff, but you've never really seen him kind of let rip on a bunch of soldiers before. I suspect one of those was Gareth. He wouldn't tell me exactly what his cameo was, but I think it was probably one of them.
Okay.
But yeah, he said Peter Jackson came and watched him shoot that bit, which was quite cool.
Oh, that's lovely.
But I like that sequence a lot. I thought it was great. I love that it was the darkness, and then you hear the breathing, and then the lightsaber ignites. You're like, okay, that's really cool. Really cool.
Another question from Adam Shortland, who says, we will assume that most people watching the film know A New Hope inside out, but if they don't, I'm not sure this film makes sense. It would be interesting to show it to someone new. I'm sure there'll be lots of questions about why a bunch of terrorists are the good guys.
Well, it all depends on your point of view, I suppose. They would see themselves as freedom fighters.
Exactly. Yeah.
It's so then
the other
a classic.
Guys do blow up an entire city.
Yeah,
they?
Yeah. That makes it fairly clear.
Yeah,
the holy city of Jeddah at that.
Yeah, I've seen a few people actually over the last couple of days, and I don't know whether this is because of the rise of a certain branch of dickheads in the real world, but a lot of people have been asking, "What is this about the Empire? Really, that makes them so evil?" I mean, it's just part of the fact that it literally said in the crawl for New Hope, you know, the evil Empire, and they blow up a planet just for shits and giggles. These are not nice people. I mean, I don't think we need to sit in a board meeting, do we? Just, you know, hear them going, "What did we destroy this week?"
And also, I mean, their iconography is taken from the Nazis.
Yes.
And if we can't agree on the badness of the Nazis, then something has gone really badly wrong. Yeah. They're literally called stormtroopers, people.
Yeah.
Wake up.
They're on the alt-right side of the force. It's not right. And again, from the Empire's point of view, yes, our heroes are terrorists. From our point of view, they're not.
He makes a valid point, though. There isn't an obvious access point in this film for people who don't know Star Wars, but then you could argue they shouldn't be watching it in the first place. But I think you have to look at it in a kind of microscopic point of view that this is it's a heist movie. You know, it's the Dirty Dozen. You know, you don't look at the larger narrative; you look at the story of this one. And I think
there is an access point, and I think it's Jyn Erso. You see a little girl whose dad is taken away by a hostile force. She grows up. She's unhappy. She finds a way to get her dad back. That's your access point.
I suppose. I think maybe because I didn't really gel with that character or find her particularly compelling. I didn't feel part of her story. I entered it as part of the, you know, the plans story, you know, part of the Star Wars story.
Yeah.
But yeah, I guess your mileage may vary in that regard.
But
we haven't talked about the many, many references as well, of which there are so many.
Well, we have a question that delineates a lot of those references.
Okay.
We'll get to that
in due course.
I got this, man. What was the question? Here's one. Tim Ford asks, did anyone notice how much footage from the first two trailers didn't make the final cut?
Yes.
Rewinds were very extensive, as plenty of scenes show Jyn running from the building. At the end, holding the plans, you'd end the final cut, they're in the machine and gone. And also there's that great shot of Krennic walking across the beach with his cloak, which is no longer in the film.
This is a rebellion. I rebel.
That's right. Mm-hmm. This is rebellion, isn't it? I rebel. Not in the film, along with Like My Fart, Stuart, and other great dialogue that hit the cutting room floor.
Yes, this is what happens in films.
Happens in films. And this is what happens, and again, we covered this with Gareth, that the marketing team take what they want, and irrespective of the final cut. The most egregious thing, or I'll say egregious, the most obvious thing is the TIE fighter at the end that you see behind Jyn on the platform. That's in the trailer. Is it attacking? Is this a rescue? Was this a different ending? That was, I think, the one that stood out for me.
Well, because there was a bit of that scene, right? Because she's on strafed. That sticky oddy bit. Yeah, and she does get strafed. So, yeah, sort of fits.
VM Sound actually has a question that links in with this one. He goes, if this film was the result of extensive reshoots to add more fun, how fucking grim must it have been pre-reshoots?
But again, I was actually surprised by how funny it was. I thought it was very funny.
I think he means the fact that everybody dies. I mean, how badly did they die in the original version?
There's that sense that Gareth's interest in kind of the beauty of horror in terms of when they blow up Jeddah, it's beautiful.
Yeah.
And there's Star Destroyers crashing into each other. They're beautiful.
Yeah.
And I think that has kind of chimes with Godzilla a little bit. He's kind of into that a little bit, I think.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And it fits in with Monsters as well, which has a very bleak ending, too. And it's certainly something that I think that interests him. Can we just go back to Jyn Erso? Because you don't like Jyn Erso. But Helen, I sensed that you did.
I did.
So let's talk about Jyn.
Sure.
Not the Qui-Gon. But Jyn Erso. What stood out for you about her? And were you a fan of Felicity Jones' performance?
I kind of was, actually. I wasn't convinced about her at all to begin with. And I sort of liked her more as she went along. If you read her as still quite young and much less experienced than her levels of cynicism would suggest, then I think she actually plays just the right line. I think it's quite powerful that way. And basically, I do sort of see it as a father-daughter story, because that's the thing that kind of gives it warmth. She sees a chance to get her father back and or clear his name, expunge his great sin, and that is what drives her through the whole rest of the film, and that is what leads her to inspire everyone around her, including those 10 dirty men who decide to go with them. So I thought that worked for me. That works at least as well as Luke Skywalker, and quite frankly, probably a lot better.
It's not the setup I had issues with. It was just more her as a character. I found her very earnest and quite bland and a bit lacking in charisma. That was, I think, I just didn't engage with her at all. She left me very cold.
I thought she was fine. I like her a lot as an actress. I thought she wasn't that great in Inferno, but then nobody was. But she's very good in this, and I really liked the reunion scene, if you will, with her and Galen.
Yeah.
The tragedy of that.
Yeah.
Of getting so close to saving her father, and then just to watch him being blown up by her own people.
Yeah.
Yep.
Now that's interesting. There's a really interesting thread that runs throughout this film about the murkiness of warfare, and I just didn't expect that to be explored.
No.
In a Star Wars movie. I mean, Star Wars movies have gone dark in the past. I mean, obviously, you have, you know, Hayden Christensen offing kids in Revenge of the Sith.
Yeah, the whole Order 66 where they saw the Jedi. That's kind of...
But this, I mean, the whole second half of this film was like Order 66. I mean, that was... Yeah. It was Order 66 writ large, really. Yeah.
Thank God it was on a beach. All this lovely death and destruction and heroic sacrifices.
It's funny, but do you think that changes the tone of it? Because it's weird, isn't it, to have, you know, the evil empire has their secret facility, you know, at a honeymoon location. It's in the Maldives.
But then,
you know, it's like the location scout.
In sandals.
This may not ring so much in this country, but of course, in America, they fought the Pacific War.
Yeah.
And, you know... those battles, Iwo Jima, all the rest, that are still very large in the American conscience. So, I don't think that necessarily takes them out in the same way it might do us.
Because it was like war as hell, but I'd really like to go there on holiday.
Yeah.
It does look like a really, really great place. Well, it did.
Yeah.
It's like the start of Thin Red Line, isn't it? Guadalcanal looking all peaceful and serene and beautiful, and Jim Caviezel like swimming around looking like Jesus. And then, what do you know?
Yeah, then admiring a leaf for 25 minutes.
I like that film.
At Miller Time, 1976 asks, favourite and worst Rogue One cameo?
My favourite and the worst.
Are they the same?
Dr. Everson. Because on
who's
one hand.
Dr. Everson.
Dr. Everson is the. And Ponda Baba, the pair of them.
Yeah, I know, but people need to know.
Are the pair from the cantina in Star Wars.
Oh, I love that. Because I thought they were going on like a galactic pub crawl.
Yeah, it did feel like
that. We're going to the Jeddah Arms, and we're going to go and get smashed at the cantina.
All right, we've got a fetish somewhere in that place. Ooh, don't like your face, mate.
To me, it was too on the nose in that, yes, see those two, but have him repeat exactly the same line. It felt like there wasn't a spin on it. It wasn't a clever reference. It was just an overt duplication.
Yeah.
For a second, I was like, that guy looks like the guy from A New... Oh! It's the guy from New.
Isn't it Michael Smiley? Because in the credits...
Michael Smiley's there, yeah.
A Michael Smiley. Whether it's... That would be hilarious.
Simon Farnaby from the Horrible Histories Yonderland and Paddington team, of course, is, I believe, Blue Five in this. He gets one line. And fitting in the Celia Imrie, what the fuck are you doing in this movie? category from Phantom Menace is Geraldine James as Blue Three.
Yeah.
Seen just enough for you to go, is that Geraldine James?
But all of them power.
It is.
All of them power. The Gold Leader. Resurrected.
And Red Leader.
Yeah.
Resurrected.
It's Garvin Dreis.
It's really good fun.
Now, is this... I read someone send in a question saying this was from... combination of CG.
It's
a combination
footage.
Of unused footage as well.
Yeah, it's archive footage.
Okay.
And it's genius. But I love the fact that you've got him talking to Red 5, who is obviously Luke in A New Hope, but there's a different Red 5 in this who gets killed, leaving the spot open for Luke to fill it in A New Hope. That is genius. I really loved it. And I love that they also had, you know, that the other pilots also had 70s tashes and sideburns and stuff so that they fit with the look of the Rebel fleet. And that's brilliant. When they have the scene where they're deciding what to do, and it does look like some kind of 1975 casting session.
Or puppet shortage nowadays.
Well, yes, that.
Ben Daniels as General Merrick has the best facial hair of the year, I'd say. We'll talk about that in the Review of the Year podcast, but that's proper good.
That was good. I think the cameo that was too far was actually R2 and C-3PO.
Unnecessary.
Mm. Yeah.
That made me smile.
I'm not mad at it, but I just felt like that was the one that felt a little bit shoehorned. My best was Bail Organa. Yeah. I was really happy to see
There's
him.
There's a lot of talk about that. How could they be on the Tantive IV when they got left behind?
It's like, do we really need to see everything?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's like, where do you stop? How did those other guys in Tantive IV get on? I want to see a separate movie now about how people boarded the Tantive IV.
They were, let me get this right, they were on Yavin 4 at that point.
Yeah.
With the rebels,
and we don't see,
and a fleet was about to leave, as it turned out, to go and support. I mean, I don't feel like this is too huge a leap to think that they might have then accompanied the rebel fleet that left the planet they were on.
Precisely.
Right?
Well, absolutely, I agree. And I honestly saw this on my own because I'm sad sack, and I watched this on my own because I'm awesome. And when they appeared, I wasn't expecting it at all, and I laughed and I smiled and it just felt right. And it feels right because I feel they should be in every Star Wars movie.
Well, that's presumably why they're there.
Yeah. And I don't know how the hell they're going to get him into the Han Solo movie, but...
But also, you want to layer your geekery, don't you? You want to have a reference that everybody gets.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You want to have Darth Vader's
And
then you
want blue milk at the beginning, you know.
Yes.
And frankly, Anthony Daniels will probably hang around the studio for months going, any chance? Any chance, guys? Hello? No? Okay.
No.
If I just stand over here, I could say, okay.
And there was Warwick Davis as well.
Yes.
So that's important.
Was he the guy who took on the tank and had the... Was that who Warwick Davis was?
The guy who took on the tank.
When Saw Gerrera's people attack in Jedha City, there's that sequence and there's a small alien. He gets like a close-up in a couple of moments.
He's got a mouth like an upside-down bowl.
Oh, yes, I know the one you mean.
Where is that?
I don't know where it is, but okay. I know the alien you're talking about. I can't remember where he appears, but yes.
The Bail Organa thing was interesting for me because he first appears just emerging from the shadows and says nothing. And I thought, is that it? Is that all we're going to get? A Bail Organa? No. Yeah. Okay, no. But you know, you get Jimmy Smits in your movie, you get Jimmy Smits in your movie.
Exactly.
And also, I tell you what I loved about the Bail Organa cameo is that it acknowledges the prequels and acknowledges the fact that prequels exist. Mm. Because, you know, yes, newsflash, I gave Attack of the Clones 5 stars, yes, that's true, but there's some great, great things in the prequels. And I don't think that George Lucas should be erased from Star Wars history, and I don't think that the prequels should be erased from Star Wars history either. So, yes to Bail Organa.
Mm. Yeah.
Indeed. And to Mustafa as well. Mustafar.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And yeah, what? Mustafa, isn't that?
That was Simba's dad, yeah. I meant Mustafar.
He's all over the place, James Earl Jones. He doesn't know which movie he's doing.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. At Bosk014 asks, I just saw Rogue One, laughed out loud several times because of sheer and pure enjoyment. However, I read my first Star Wars book, Catalyst, all about Galen Erso. My question is, his hubris, insisting on researching the crystals, caused him to lose everything, his wife and daughter, ultimately his daughter. So it's an even sadder ending in a way, because in the end he lost everything he hoped to keep safe. Not so much a question, really, just more of a really depressing statement.
Oh.
Thank you for that.
But props to Galen Erso for naming a weapon of mass destruction after his only child, which is weird.
Just Stardust.
Yeah.
I was going to say, yeah, this is my daughter, Death Star Erso.
Maybe he's a really big fan of Neil Gaiman. You Perhaps. Don't know. Or Matthew Vaughn.
Or Jane Goldman. Yeah.
I thought it was a lovely touch. Lovely touch. What did we make of the other code names? I only caught a couple when they were going through the files. It felt like a Jason Bourne movie suddenly broke out in the middle of it. Going, there's Blackbriar Treadstone.
I thought it was like The Cube with Philip Schofield, where he had to kind of negotiate the arms, and they lose a life, and then
it's a physical challenge.
I don't know.
Black Saber was one of the code names I got. Did anyone know what that
maybe
means?
Maybe in 40 years they can do a standalone film about that.
Yeah. Star Wars Black
Saber. It's Darksaber, isn't
it? What's that?
It's a novel, isn't it? Or a comic or something.
Someone said it might be a reference to Rebels, but yeah, we'll see. At Lanky Marion, or Ian Key Marion. I think I've maybe been mispronouncing this in the podcast for a long time. I think it may be Ian Key Marlin. Marlin! Oh my God. Anyway. Whatever your name is, asks, how did Dr. Cornelius Evasan and his mate survive the destruction of Jedha? Again, we don't need to see that, do we?
They left already. There's like a day in between. It's fine.
What goes on to her stays on to her. They just...
So just the ruins, smoking ruins of Jedha City, and then they just emerge.
Two alcoholics.
Hey! Then it becomes the hangover. Yeah, they have to retrace their steps.
Amazing. The Chef Insider asks about things we've already talked about, but says, would have loved to have seen a spin-off movie just following Donnie Yen and Chang Wen, or Wen Zhang.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're great.
That's the best relationship in the film to me, those
two. Well, they're R2 and 3PO, aren't they?
Yes, it's in Fortress, isn't it?
Yeah, they're based on the same two characters as R2 and 3PO. Yeah.
Oh, are they?
Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, that's very interesting. So will they be in all the other Star Wars movies now as well? Just embedded there. I thought they were fantastic. I thought Donnie Yen was great.
Yeah.
I thought there was real, surprising emotion when
very
he died.
Much so. Yeah.
When I knew it was coming. Thanks. I just loved the I'm one with the Force. The Force is with me.
Yeah.
His faith in the Force and what that gave him as a character, and also he's Donnie Yen. He just kicks ass.
He really
does.
He's so cool to watch.
He's very, very cool. He had just a lovely sense of serenity and calm.
Yeah. But then the fact that he had Baze kind of backing him up and stepping in when, you know, things got a little bit too hot even for a martial artist like him, I thought was great as well. And that sort of sense of exasperation, like, all right, I'll open fire.
The Force saved me. I saved you. Yeah, I love those two. Their dynamic was great. Loads of fun.
Admit One Movies 2 asks, why so much rain? What particular emotion were the filmmakers trying to evoke with so much rain?
Kurosawa. It's a Kurosawa reference. Yeah. Yeah. Always raining in Kurosawa. Yeah.
Always rain.
Yeah, it's like Manchester.
Yeah, Dagobah, the Manchester of the... Does it rain in Dagobah? It kind of does.
No, it's just a bit...
Does it?
Yeah.
It rains on R2 when he peers through the window.
Yeah, yeah. It does. Mm. I'd say probably a thick sheen of despair is what they were trying to evoke. They're trying to set you up, aren't they? I mean,
Well, no, mate, I was just going to say, Gareth Edwards talked about not so much going back to the Star Wars movies as the movies that inspired Star Wars, yeah. Right? So yeah. That is literally all the Kurosawas and all that kind of stuff.
But the opening of the movie where we see Mads Mikkelsen as Galen Erso with hair that makes him look like John Wick's brother.
Yeah, on Iceland.
On Iceland. And you have that incredible, just that sense of the really horrible, horrible weather and Krennic's cloak flapping around. Mm. I just love that. I love the fact that right from the off, it's basically going, here's a bleak landscape, guys. Yeah. This is pretty much where the movie's going.
Someone tweeted in, and you should find the name you got there, Chris, is that, why did he park so far from the house?
It's a fair point.
Find that name. It's a very good joke, and we should credit that joke to somebody.
It's Tom Lathwaite, at Tom Lathwaite. At the start of the film, why did he park so far from the house?
Maybe he had a moment of actual consideration and didn't want to burn the crops.
Yeah. Maybe
that seems really in character.
Yeah.
But maybe his pilot was considerate.
Or maybe it was just a mother and child space near the house and he didn't want to break the law. Who knows?
I thought it was a perfect scene to run credits over. If you were going to do a credit sequence.
I thought so as well.
So,
oh, yeah.
Rather than the big Rogue One that comes up.
Yeah.
The title bothered me. Like it sort of slapped like an unwelcome cockshot. It just kind of was there on your screen. You're trying to avoid it, and it was just like, you know, it really bothered me that it comes back to the title thing. There was no crawl. There was no Star Wars. There was no fanfare. And the Rogue One title, yeah, it didn't sit.
I think in time you will learn to embrace it.
Really?
Yes. In time, you will call me master. Yes.
You want this?
You? Yeah. I think you may have font issues.
Yes, I had. As Christopher Walken had, I have font issues.
Dewey Howells asks, has there been a more monumental case of seeing your own power turned against you than director Krennic's front row seat to the Death Star's destruction of the Empire's space library? Yeah, that's a really, really great point. That he was alive long enough to go, oh, bugger.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
Ouch. Poetic justice, people. Yeah. Poetic justice.
And we all love Mendelsohn.
I loved him. Yeah. I thought he was great.
I love him as an actor. I didn't particularly feel the arc, I guess. I didn't particularly feel his...
Never mind
he
the
didn't
arc,
feel
feel
like
an,
no, but he didn't feel like a powerful baddie to be reckoned with in the end.
I don't think he was.
I'm not saying it was meant to, yeah. But that was less effective for me than... And I guess, you know, he didn't have to be. He was backed up by Tarkin and Vader, which is a pretty good set of sidekicks. But I don't know, I just find something vaguely narratively unsatisfying about his story.
I liked him a lot. I thought he was very, very good. It's interesting, because you said that on the regular podcast this week as well, about him, which kind of set me up, because I expected him to be usurped as a main bad guy.
Right.
Judging from your comments, because I hadn't seen it at that point. And he
isn't really.
He isn't. But he has that... He has that obsession with Erso, who, in an interesting wrinkle, you get the sense he considered to be his friend.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, they clearly were, because they're having drinks earlier on.
And in Coruscant or somewhere a lot like it, if not.
Yeah,
yeah, they were university buddies.
Yeah, yeah, you get Dr. Evasan and...
No, they are, if you read in Catalyst.
Okay, they are. Okay, I haven't read it, because I'm sorry. But just out of shot, you get Dr. Evasan getting pissed in the same bar.
In the student union, in Coruscant.
Swing at you, mate! Scottish now, for some reason.
I like that even though he's an Imperial, he's not English. I thought that really set him apart. He was Australian.
Was he?
Where's me fucking playing, you mongrel?
Everybody just pretty much brought their own accents to the party, and that kind of worked, actually, for me. Yeah. I rather liked it.
But it comes back to the thing that Edward was saying, that he's like the equivalent of the working-class boy done good in a group of public school you know, eaten.
Yes.
Yeah. Bullingdon Club types. And you get that idea that he's got a massive inferiority complex.
Oh, yeah, you definitely get that.
And I really liked that about him, yeah. that he was so heavily flawed.
He was a grey-haired toady who was ingratiating himself with a much, much more powerful person. The moment when he went to see Fader and Mustafar reminded me of a certain someone getting into a gold lift with another certain someone. Yeah. But hey, maybe I'm reading too much into it.
I wasn't sure about seeing Vader in Bacta Tank. The first time we see him, we don't see him as Vader. That seems a strange decision to me.
Yeah, that's...
I thought it was going to be the Emperor, because there's a guy coming in with the robe and whatnot, and obviously Ian McDiarmid's still
walking
around.
Yes, I wondered about that. That kind of freaked me out slightly. Mm. But you're seeing him in the tank. I mean, it was a callback to The Empire Strikes Back.
Yeah.
You know, you see the back of his head, but that was a nice sequence. He's just like a torso floating in soup.
Yeah, absolutely. You mentioned references earlier on, Jimbo, and someone sent in a question, and I'm so sorry I didn't get your name, because I did this last minute. It says, listed a number of ones, so this guy was really watching this film with fine detail. It says, there are moisture evaporators and blue milk in the Ursa's home. Mm-hmm. In Jin's dream, they appear to be in Coruscant, as you said, mm-hmm. Helen. Ponda Baba and Dr. Evasan, yes, we noticed that. The Guardians of the Wills, reference to the Journal of the Wills. Saw Gerrera's place, his men are playing Dejrak with solid figures, not holograms.
That's a great shout.
So I missed all this stuff. Yeah. Captain Antilles reference, we mentioned. Mm-hmm. Fader in the back of the tank, Gold Reader, Red Leader, Red 5 being destroyed, you mentioned that. Mm-hmm. In Yavin 4, over the PA, they call for General Syndulla, which could be a reference to Hera Syndulla from Star Wars Rebels.
Okay,
or her dad.
That's cool.
Apparently the Ghost, which is the ship in Star Wars Rebels, can be seen at one point in the final battle as well. And the Hammerhead Corvette, which is the ship that smashes the Star Destroyer into each other, is a direct nod to Rebels. Those ships were arranged to be stolen from Princess Leia by the Rebels. Stolen, with inverted commas, to preserve Alderaan's neutrality. So that's all very exciting.
He missed out the mouse robot, which you don't see, but you do hear.
Yeah.
Also, the Death Star droid appears twice. He appears once in his silver incarnation, which you remember from the original films. He appears also in a kind of a rather nice stealth matte black. And I wondered whether that was a reference to K2SO, who in the original John Knoll treatment was an Imperial Protocol droid, who I believe was in black, and then he became this kind of tactician new model droid later on. So I wondered if that's what that was, as I push my glasses up my nose.
And adjust your pocket protector.
At Cunningham JH asks, is this the best looking Star Wars film?
Ooh.
Interesting. I don't know how to answer that.
I mean, it's certainly up there. It was gorgeous. The use of locations was absolutely fantastic.
And that's the biggest problem with the prequels, is so much of it is...
Although, when they do go on location, they really go on location. Yeah, like Seville, Lake Como, those kind of places were great. But I mean, even Canary Wharf looked amazing, so... You got to give props to that.
It is amazing. Also, I love the 70s throwback stuff. I love that when they did the Death Star ignition sequence, I genuinely was like, is this archive footage if they completely, you know, recreated the console with like 70s knobs and levers? Yeah. I thought that was fantastic.
There's some amazing shots of the Death Star that we've never seen before from angles we've never seen.
Yes, upside down. In shadow, coming around a planet, all that kind of stuff was gorgeous.
That shot of arriving in Scarif is just fantastic. I absolutely adored that. You know, you can see why they made it a poster.
Yeah.
Ultimately, which one do you like? The Star Destroyer?
The Star Destroyer coming out of shadow, which is in one of the trailers. That's a beautiful shot.
Yeah. And the Star Destroyer being over the Jedha City as well. I love that shot. Mm. That shot too.
There's a lot of really nice stuff in there. Yeah. You know, the AT-ST running through the streets shooting things. That's lovely. Mm. You know, there's so much stuff in there. So much fan service, and some of it's so well done. Some of it very unsubtle and not as good, but some of it just genius.
Mm. Yeah.
LaPaz asks very quickly, do you think Jin Erso having a kyber crystal was a strange plot point that never really went anywhere? I guess that's explained by the book. And
maybe it didn't have to be. Maybe it was literally just a symbol of her attachment to her family and her father's obsession with the crystals, I guess. But I mean, maybe there might have been an earlier incarnation of the script where she actually used it for something in particular.
I liked the idea that the Death Star was powered by kyber crystals, because they're a very scarce resource. And obviously that explains why they're not just building these things left, right and centre. Obviously, they're also planet-sized. But I thought that was kind of a nice touch, that this is a scarce resource. It's difficult to build a Death Star.
Yeah,
it's nice to have something that's used for good and for evil.
Yeah, this is a Jedi weapon.
Yeah,
two-edged sword.
Yeah.
And the very last question. This comes from at Sean Rival, and he says, I'm a huge fan of Star Wars. I was wondering if you guys could give me your definitive list of favourite droids in the series. Now we're 8 movies in, maybe not all droids. BB-8 and K2SO have almost stolen the last 2 movies with their mixture of wit and cute charm. I'd be interested to hear who the pod favours the most, and maybe more interestingly, the least?
I'm going to have to be pretty, you know, pretty straightforward and go R2, BB-8, K2, and then a huge gap. And then all the other droids ever, including C-3PO, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Mm. Maybe a less huge gap for C-3PO and then all the others.
Siri's clearly upset that we haven't listed her.
That's
on the...
genuinely terrifying. What did you say to just trigger Siri? Okay.
It's all very bizarre.
C-3PO.
Oh,
do you think that's probably it?
You said C-3PO.
Hey, C-3PO. Okay. 3PO! Where can he be? 3PO's way down the list for me.
Yeah.
I put the mouse right above 3PO.
So would I.
Jimbo?
Do you know what? It's funny. I have a real... BB-8 kind of stole my heart a lot in Force Awakens, just because he has such amazing gags. But the reason for that is so much emphasis is placed on him in a way that was never placed on R2. So R2 will always have a place in my heart. But if I could have one droid for my own personal use, it'd be BB-8.
What's the medical droid? What's that one called?
Well, that's 2-1-B.
It is 2-1-B.
My favourite 2-1-B.
Because they're underpaid. They work so hard. You know, they spend years being students.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know...
If we could just take the 350 million credits a week that we send to the Empire and redirect it to the medical robots...
2-1-B could get a mortgage.
Put that on the side of an AT-AT, yeah. And then you're laughing, aren't you?
I was thinking, okay. In the office, we could do with Jabba's Jobsworth droid. We have need of you on the Master's sail barge.
He is awesome. And the little fat squat one. Yeah, I like that as well. Yeah. K2SO, I thought was fantastic.
Really, really he was very good.
Okay, right. That is all the time we have because we're about to be kicked out of the pod booth. Really enjoyed this film. Really enjoyed talking to you guys as well. And that is it. That's it. That's all the time we have. We're about to be kicked out of the pod booth. That's it for a Rogue One, a Star Wars story spoiler special. Sorry if we didn't answer all your questions, but I kind of feel we did. In a way. Don't forget the regular podcast, the Mothership podcast, the Star Destroyer podcast is up every Friday. So please subscribe to that if you don't already. Give us a nice review on iTunes as well if you fancy that too. Our Review of the Year pod is also coming. Our next spoiler special hasn't been confirmed yet, but if you were to put money on it being Logan, it wouldn't be the daftest bet in the world. Until then, it is goodbye from Helen.
Toodaloo.
It's goodbye from James.
There is another podcast.
Meaning, of course, the Review of the Year, which we're recording next.
Yes. And it's goodbye from Ian.
You say goodbye, I say or so.
Hey! Or so.
You've been working on that the whole way through, haven't you?
For 3 weeks I've been playing that.
And it's goodbye from me. I'm off to make a short film about how 3PO and R2 got in the Tantive 4, because that sort of thing matters, apparently. See you next time. Bye. Okay, so that was the spoiler special, the first take, and now it's time for a new section, a brief section, but one I felt that this was important for us to do.
It is.
Helen is here, I'm here, and we're going to talk about the late, great Carrie Fisher. And I think it's fitting in a way that we're talking about Rogue One, because even though we know we're going to see Carrie Fisher as Leia in Episode 8 next year, the end of this movie inadvertently became a weird, great tribute to Carrie Fisher and to Princess Leia. I know a couple of people who got in touch with me on Twitter and they said that they cried when they saw the film after her death because they A, didn't know she was going to be in it, and obviously B, it took them by surprise and it, you know, brought up a whole lot of emotional baggage there.
I find it very moving. I went back to see it with my family after Christmas and after her death, and it is it does give you a little moment of pause to see her again. And then I actually went back and watched the original trilogy over Christmas. And
oh, really? The whole thing?
The whole thing. Wow. And Leia is not on screen as much as you think, but her influence is so outsized that it's quite astonishing. I mean, the first film in particular is her story. She is actually not only the impetus for the story beginning, her message gets everybody going, but she is by some distance the most sort of, you know, competent, in control person. She is the one with the plan to fight the Empire, really. She is the one who's kind of making all of that move, and you know, there's some farm boy who's kind of tagging along for the ride and like this hotshot pilot who's helping them out a little bit. That's kind of it though. You know,
well, we did a back and forth not obituary, but we did a back and forth discussion about Carrie Fisher after she died on the Empire website, and you know, for anyone who read that, I'm going to repeat a couple of points here, but it's fascinating watching Leia in A New Hope because she is fully formed. I mean, George Lucas gets so much crap over the years for not being able to write dialogue or not being able to write characters, but New Hope's full of indelible, fully yeah. formed characters right from the off. And obviously a lot of that has to do with the actors as well. But there's something about Leia, you know, she's not just a damsel in distress. She's in a prison cell for pretty much the first hour, 70, 80 minutes of the movie. But she has such authority and such sass and and fire that it's just fun watching her. It's fun watching her kind of assess everybody she meets with a withering disdain. You know, like Grand Moff Tarkin, she insults him. She says he smells. And you do wonder how he smells. He must smell pretty bad.
He probably smells like lavender. Didn't he actually smell like lavender? But I think that's kind of interesting, because also he doesn't really react to that, which says to me they've had that conversation. They've been in that fight before. Yeah. And he doesn't want to get drawn into a war of words with this woman because he's worried she'll win.
Yeah. Absolutely. So, you know, he escalated pretty quickly, it has to be said, by blowing up her home planet. Yeah. But she has his number. Smelly Tarkin. You know, Luke Skywalker. She immediately disses his height. Aren't you a little short to be a stormtrooper? Oh, thanks a bunch. And then, of course, Han Solo. She sees through Han Solo immediately.
Yeah.
You know, which sets in motion the events that obviously lead to their relationship.
His look of betrayal when she really sort of fires off in the corridor, that speech ending with, "Will someone get this walking carpet out of my way?" His look of just, I know how this is supposed to go. This is not how it's supposed to go. He's like a kid whose toy has been taken away. He's so upset by it.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
I had forgotten she does diss Chewie as well, so.
Yeah, but Chewie can take it.
A couple of points in the old debit column there.
Hey. She had like a cuddly toy Wookiee as a child, didn't she? I don't know if that's canon anymore, but there's certainly been a reference to that somewhere. So I think it's okay.
Walking carpet. She's so good in that film. And she was just brilliant throughout the trilogy. Mm. She gets a lot of not just heavy lifting to do emotionally. The whole Han and Leia storyline, but the stuff in Return of the Jedi. She has to make acting opposite a bunch of teddy bears seem real, and she sells it, totally sells it, completely sells it. But the scene that for me that really stands out for me anyway, that showed Carrie Fisher's skills as an actress, and you know, the ability to take that, you can type the ship but you can't say a dialogue, is the scene where Luke tells her that in very quick succession she finds out Vader is her dad, she's Luke's sister, and she's strong in the Force herself. And that's a really difficult scene. And she nails it.
Yeah.
Absolutely gets it.
And yet that's probably the Leia that's furthest from the one we first see. Mm. And I think a cynic would say that's them trying to sort of feminize her a bit and kind of soften her rough edges. You could also see it as just growing maturity. Like she's been through a lot with these guys. She's kind of changed as a result of that. And I think that's an equally valid sort of reading of it. But It I think plays in nicely to The Force Awakens, because you see the compassion she shows in that scene and the sort of maturity of emotion, I think carries through to, you know, The Force Awakens, because, you know, as well as losing two sets of parents, I mean, you know, which begins to look like carelessness, as Oscar Wilde said, two sets of parents, her planet, God knows how many allies in fights over the years, her husband to separation, her son to the dark side.
Yeah.
She does not waver. She is the Skywalker who does not even contemplate the dark side. Mm. I mean...
Mm. It is. It's interesting. It feels a missed opportunity, perhaps, that in Jedi we don't get to see her have a scene with Vader after that. That revelation, it would have been interesting, because you have Luke, who processes the information that Vader is his dad, and Luke is very clearly feeling the pull towards the dark side throughout Jedi. That's very, very clear. I don't think Leia would have felt that. I think that she would have been, she's stronger than Luke in many, many ways. And it would have been interesting to see how that would have manifested itself.
Yeah, maybe it would have unbalanced things. Maybe he couldn't have sort of, sounds weird, but maybe he couldn't have resisted her. Maybe he couldn't have dismissed her. Maybe he wouldn't have, I don't know.
It does put the first scene of New Hope into sharp perspective, doesn't it, when you realize that that's the first scene she has with Vader is
Oh my God, that's your dad.
Father and daughter. Yeah, it's pretty cool. But also, there's, you know, it has a certain reflection in the, you know, what happens in between Jedi and Force Awakens, in that she effectively does give birth to Darth Vader 2.0 and isn't able to bring herself to bear on that situation.
I think that's really interesting, actually, because I think it's, we're used to these figures, these female figures in science fiction or whatever, or just generally in the world, being portrayed as, you know, mother figures. And it is still one of the greatest sort of sins that you can accuse a woman of, is being a bad mother, if they are a mother. Otherwise, it's just weird. And you know, at some point, you kind of have to wonder. I mean, and again, we don't want to get into to sort of making accusations that we don't know the background of. At some point, you have to wonder, did Leia fail Ben? And presumably, at some point, she did a little bit. Presumably, she didn't. She wasn't able to communicate this great strength that she has and this great belief that she has to her son. So that does feel like a failing. And I think it may go back to her commitment to the cause, which always came first in every single film, I think. But it's an interesting wrinkle in her character. And when people say she's idealized, I think that really cuts against it, because I don't think she is quite. And I think it's really interesting.
Yeah. I mean, if we accept that Han Solo is fatally flawed, which he is, we have to accept that there are some flaws within Princess Leia. Yeah. There simply have to be. And Kylo Ren is a pretty big flaw. I want to see the Jeremy Kyle episode. Or Kylo episode.
I do wonder slightly if how that's going to play out. I mean, obviously, we're presuming now she won't be in episode 9 unless they're able to sort of reallocate some scenes from episode 8. We have no idea. We don't know enough about it, I think.
Yeah.
But I wonder if that's going to necessitate big changes in that sort of arc and in that character. That would be obviously a worry for, I guess, Colin Trevorrow right now.
Absolutely. Still too far out, I think, to really talk about it, but it's going to be intriguing, that's for sure. But you know, it's been fascinating watching, as ever on Twitter, this outpouring of grief and love. What did Leia mean to you?
Oh, she was my heroine. I genuinely, I wrote this in another piece recently that I played as Leia in the playground.
Really?
And the first comment basically was like, I don't remember girls playing Star Wars. And I'm like, well, you're wrong. but it was great, because it was genuinely a cast iron excuse to play with the boys. If the boys are playing Star Wars, and they always were because it was the 80s, then I was like, well, I'm going to be Leia. And then they had to let me play. So it was kind of fun. But, you know, what you would do as Leia is you'd basically sit in a corner for 5 minutes while they figured out how to rescue you. And it would take a little while of running around and waving your arms about pretending to have blasters. And then you'd take over, because that's what Leia does. it was the greatest. I always loved Princess Leia. Possibly aging myself here. My parents saw Star Wars when my mother was pregnant, heavily pregnant with me.
Okay.
And my dad drove home pretending to be an X-Wing pilot.
That's dangerous.
And so I feel like my, you know, my love
goes... Well done
for
being here.
Thanks, yeah. I feel like my love goes back a long way.
Yes. It feels that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. I just remember... I mean, I have so many favourite Leia moments, and I realise we're not really talking about Rogue One at this point in time, but whatever. You know, we will in a second. I have so many favourite Leia moments. Because I had a huge Star Wars toy collection when I was growing up, and...
I would have been so jealous.
Yeah. She's fascinating within the context of the trilogy, just the evolution, because as a kid, it did take me a while to get over to realize that she wasn't Luke's love interest, you know, as a whatever
sure,
age,
yeah.
you know. Because they have that moment where she kisses him good luck as they swing across the chasm in the Death Star, which for me is one of the most romantic moments in the history of cinema, and is now tainted with ickiness. You're just going, what's happening here? But I love that moment. I still love that moment. I love the fact that she has a British accent when she talks to Tarkin and an American accent when she talks to everybody else. I think that's amazing. So many great moments in Empire.
Oh my God. The love scene in Empire is the absolute pinnacle for me.
There's a love scene?
Not sexy. Sex scene.
Okay.
No. Although if you ever listen to Kirsch's commentary on that, he's cackling about it.
Really?
You know, he's like, this is a kiss, which in this film is the equivalent of sex.
It didn't go in. It just impacted on the surface.
Oh, Chris.
What?
No. No.
Okay.
Inappropriate. Anyway, but the whole I happen to like nice men, you know.
Yeah.
I'm nice men.
Of course,
She says,
that's a great line.
Nerf herder.
She says scruffy looking nerf herder.
It's just one, you know, one of the best words ever. So many great moments. And, you know, I am going to mention the gold bikini.
Sure.
Because she makes it work. Again, she had this incredible ability to take things that should not have worked mm-hmm. on page, whether it's dialogue scenes or the emotional content of a scene or a gold bikini.
Yeah, that is some extreme underwiring right there.
And turn it around and strangle a giant Muppet and just own it. I mean, I'm sure you've seen the Rolling Stone shots that were done with Carrie Fisher at the time. Where she's on the beach in the gold bikini.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, there was someone, I don't know this lady's name, posted a picture of an outtake I'd never seen where she's being engulfed in water in the. Have you seen this picture?
I don't know if I have.
She's on the beach and she's being engulfed by a wave and there's just pure delight on her face. It's one of the best pictures I think I've ever seen. It's extraordinary. And she took that and she made it work. And one of the very best Friends episodes came out of that. So I'm very, very happy about that as well.
Bikini makes a lot of people very happy, actually.
But honestly, I never, and this is maybe because I saw it at a certain age or whatever, it never sexualized Leia for me.
Mm.
And I never saw it as, I just saw it as what Jabba's dancers wear, giant slimy slug makes his dancers wear.
It was the first one I saw. I saw them all out of order. I saw 3, 1, 2. I was young. We went to the cinema and my dad kind of filled me in on what was happening. It was fine.
But your dad was an X-Wing fighter pilot. I don't understand.
He was able to explain the plot as a result of that.
Yeah.
Anyway, I mean, I think if you know, there have been sort of feminists out there who complained about the bikini, and sure, some of those criticisms are fair, you know.
Yeah.
But at the same time, as metaphors go, she then strangles the thing that put her in it
mm-hmm.
and changes into her normal clothes, as Carrie Fisher herself pointed out. Mm. Not a bad message. So really, you know, I've never seen a problem with that. It never felt like, you know, it never felt icky to me because of that.
And she gets to do one more great swing with Luke.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
she drives the plot of Jedi so much with the, you know, going off on the speeder bikes, and she has that great moment towards the end where Han says, "I love you," and then she says, "I know."
And then she shoots two people dead.
Then she shoots two people dead. So romantic. Aww. So much fun. She was so good. And I, you know, I have the T-shirt. I have the Han T-shirt saying, "I love you." I've got the Han T-shirt saying, "I know," and the Leia T-shirt saying, "I love you." And then at another Star Wars celebration, you could get the same T-shirts but swapped.
That's good.
That was pretty cool. She was great. We're going to talk about Carrie Fisher in wider context and the rest of her career on the regular podcast as well. But within Star Wars, within this legacy that she left. She was a giant, and it's obviously a huge tragedy because she was at the cusp of this great second act of her life. She seemed so content. She seemed that she had really come to terms with Leia and the legacy of Leia, and what that meant for her life and what that meant for her career. And it's such a shame to see her snatched away in circumstances like this. There was a great story. I don't know if you read this. Over Christmas, about someone said that someone owned a comic book store
mm-hmm.
and said one day Carrie Fisher breezed into the comic book store with 10 minutes to go until it was closing and proceeded to buy everything Star Wars related, everything Princess Leia related. She walked around with assistants, just, you know, "What's this? Okay, put it in the bag. I just want to know what became of that stuff. Did she give it away to charity? Did she keep it? Did she have a Princess Leia shrine, a museum? What was going on there? But that's a lovely, lovely, lovely story.
I went to a screenwriting talk she did once at the British Library.
Oh, wow.
And I don't remember everything that she said because I have a terrible memory. But I do remember her talking about actually the bikini scene.
Really?
And talking about her waking up her daughter, who must have been young at the time, like 11 maybe.
Mm.
And so her daughter had fallen asleep when they were watching Jedi, or maybe they've been doing a marathon, and she literally like poked her awake and said, look, it's me with the hot body. You have to look. This is your legacy. You've got to watch this bit." So yeah, she was hilarious.
She was great. She was great. And we should probably just talk about the Rogue One thing again. I think I said in the previous podcast that, you know, the previous section that we recorded anyway, that I had issues with people being brought back digitally, and I don't think the CG was all there, but
context changes everything, I think. And now I think it is. It's a lovely tribute. I haven't seen Rogue One since she passed, and I'm a bit worried about how I'm going to react.
It was. Yeah, it's a lot to see now, but it's really nice. I mean, I also love just the Jimmy Smits moment earlier.
Yeah,
I'd trust her with my life. I adore that. Yeah. I kind of wish they'd had a scene together, and obviously that never happened because of, you know, real life timelines. But
yeah.
But I thought that was great as well, and maybe it makes up a little bit for her never having that father-daughter scene with Vader.
Okay, well, I think you and I could probably talk about Carrie Fisher and Leia for hours, but this is probably a nice point in which to end.
Yeah.
And that is it for our Rogue One, a Star Wars story spoiler special. That's not easy to say.
It's a lot of S's in a row.
It's a lot of S's. I don't think they thought that through. I don't think they thought about poor podcast hosts when they changed the title. Why not just Star Wars Rogue One? That's what it was.
Maybe it's because, you know, then it sounds like it's not a spin-off. Like, it sounds like it's part of... Anyway,
yeah.
This is...
Anyway, yeah. Our next spoiler special is likely to be for Logan, which comes out in March. Now, of course, if our recent track record with spoiler specials is anything to go by, then our spoiler special for that will be out in May. But hopefully, keep them peeled in March. And keep them peeled just generally for specials and spoiler specials, because you never know when one might unexpectedly drop.
Ooh.
I'm hoping that something happens soon, but I can't say.
All right.
Yeah.
Ooh.
Oh, yeah. Very exciting. The regular podcast is, of course, out every Friday, so do listen to that if you liked what you heard here, and if you didn't, please listen to it anyway. Until next time, James and Ian have already said goodbye in their little portion. It's farewell from Helen.
Goodbye.
It's farewell from me. And this podcast is, of course, dedicated to the memory of the late, great Carrie Fisher. The Force will be with her always.